Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty on this very last Wednesday of March. On today's show, petition gatherers appear to have turned in enough signatures to put a referendum on wolf hunting in Michigan on a statewide ballot. We'll talk with the director of the Keep Michigan Wolves Protected campaign. And it was a tragically, heartbreakingly familiar story back in 2008. Auto jobs being lost in our state. We will take a look back 5 years ago later in the show. But first, it should be that every senior citizen in Michigan is safe and secure with no threat of abuse. But that is not the case. Elder abuse is real, whether that abuse is physical, emotional, even financial. And it's one of the most underreported crimes in our state and across the country. One guess is that 100,000 seniors in Michigan will be victimized by someone looking to take advantage of them. This morning, it was my privilege to MC the unveiling of a new campaign in Michigan called No Excuse for Elder Abuse. I was able to introduce a panel of high-ranking judges and prosecutors representing seven counties in southeast Michigan, and that includes my next guest, Macomb County Prosecutor Eric Smith. Welcome to Stateside.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me.
So when we use that term elder abuse, specifically, what are we talking about?
Well, there's so many different forms of it. And we're talking about physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional, psychological abuse, neglect, abandonment, and something that we see growing exponentially is financial exploitation. And in your intro, I heard you talking about stats and numbers. The National Center on Elder Abuse estimates that between 1 and 2 million elderly adults have suffered from some form of elder abuse. So this is a problem that's very severe and is growing by the day.
And it's underreported, isn't it? And why is that? Is it because the seniors are afraid or they don't know where to go or what to do?
Well, it's underreported for a lot of reasons. That's certainly part of it, that they're afraid to talk about it, not exactly sure where to talk about it. But in a lot of the cases involving physical abuse, neglect, financial exploitation, the people that we're talking about committing these crimes are people who we entrust to take care of our elders or the seniors. You know, we're talking about family members, home care workers, children. So the people that would be reporting these crimes in any other situation are oftentimes, you know, the subjects of our inquiries. And even more so, seniors themselves are always worried about having their liberties restricted or taken away. And if a senior gets scammed on the phone by some scam artist and loses thousands of dollars, oftentimes they're afraid to tell anyone about that because they're afraid they're going to lose their ability to live on their own and lose all kinds of other liberties because they're vulnerable and other people will see them that way. So they're afraid to tell anyone. So that makes them even more targeted by other people.
I'm talking with Macomb County Prosecutor Eric Smith about the just unveiled campaign, No Excuse for Elder Abuse. I'm curious, can you give us, Eric, details of, let's say, a case of elder abuse that really sticks in your mind to give us a sense of what elder abuse really looks and feels like?
Well, gosh, we've had so many of them. But we recently had a Ponzi scam here that took millions of dollars from a victim in his 90s and his sister, who was in her late 80s. And it was by a family member, or it was by someone that they had known for many years, a younger guy who had been, it was so bad that he was taking their money and supposedly investing it in stocks. And he was printing his own stocks and sending it to him as though he was buying these things. And what he was doing was he was taking so much money that he was giving them back dividends that were, if it was real dividends, they were making great money. But the problem was he was taking hundreds of thousands of dollars and giving them back thousands. But the net result is they were losing millions of dollars. And at the end of the day, that money was long gone.
Cleaned out.
So, yeah, more than $1 million in this case.
And as you say, it's people that are tend to be within their circle. So when it's reported, or like, who's blowing the whistle then? If it's children or caregivers or maybe family friends who are preying on the elderly, who's blowing the whistle?
Well, in that specific case, they went to an elder law attorney to talk about finances and to talk about trusts, and they started looking into this. A well-known attorney here in Mount Clemens, Pat Samasco, they started looking into this and thought, something's wrong with this, and instantly contacted our senior hotline or our senior fraud prosecutor, Suzanne Fonts. And as soon as they looked into it, they saw very quickly that there was a crime going on. So I guess the way to get around this is when you feel like you're being scammed, the police are always an excellent asset. There's always lawyers out there. There's the senior fraud hotline that we have in our county, and then there's the number for the state fraud hotline that we're going to give out in a few minutes as well.
Yes.
So there's many ways to get about it, but the last thing in the world you want to do is keep it to yourself, because once you keep it to yourself, these people get emboldened. So if they're scamming you through the phone or through emails, if they've gotten a few $100 from you, then a few $1,000 from you, then a few tens of thousands of dollars, they know they can keep coming back because they know they have the senior on the hook.
And that's the financial side. And it just, as you were earlier, Eric Smith, talking about the physical or the sexual abuse, you just shudder. And I can only imagine if you have a frail senior citizen who's mainly homebound, who's going to really see that and who's going to be aware of that? What can the public do to be more aware?
You know, we see this oftentimes that people are afraid to get involved in other people's lives. And I understand that completely, and we've been down this road with child abuse. So through our child abuse unit, we put out the anonymous 1-800 number. Well, the state also has an elder abuse anonymous number. So if you feel like a neighbor, a friend, or someone that you're just an acquaintance with, if you have a hinky feeling or a bad feeling that something bad may be going on with them, you can call this number and you are 100% anonymous. We don't even find out who made that call.
Mm.
So then the state starts doing an investigation. It's through the Department of Human Services.
And as a prosecutor, can I ask you, do you feel that investigation is fast and proactive? Do you know what I'm saying? Because there's times when things seem to slip through the cracks.
Sure.
Can the public feel confident that call will be investigated?
Absolutely. Every one of them is looked into. Everyone now, depending on the severity of the allegations in it, you know, if you call up and say my neighbor is bleeding every day, mm-hmm. you know, that may get a quicker response than
sure.
you know, she doesn't look good. But every one of them is looked into. So, you know, we've gotten quite a few cases through this to our office, through the police department and to our office through this statewide number. So it works out very well. So people don't have to worry about being involved because, you know, if you're a neighbor, mm-hmm. you know the senior citizen next door, you may know their kids. You don't want them to think that you're making a call to look into their lives. Well, if the Department of Human Services just shows up, they have no idea who made this call. So you're not being implicated in anything and you have no other responsibility other than making that initial report.
And I'm going to stop and give that confidential hotline for reporting abuse. That number is 855-444-3911. And we'll give it again before we finish. Now, I'm curious, Eric, as the prosecutor from Macomb County and your other prosecutors around Michigan, do you have the tools once you get a case? Has Michigan law given you the tools you need?
You know, there's been a trend in recent years towards strengthening guidelines and sentences towards elder abuse. For an awful long time, you would see a bad guy go into a 7-Eleven and steal $20 and go to prison for 15 years, but he would scam a senior citizen out of $100,000 and get probation. So we've been able to work with our state legislators overall. And on that, as a matter of fact, on the case we were talking about, the Ponzi scheme, you know, he can be in prison up to 15 years. He's in prison right now, and he may be serving as many as 15 years, depending on parole and things like that. But he actually went to prison, which is a big step in prosecuting elder abuse cases.
And I guess the whole idea of the no excuse for elder abuse is number one, let citizens know there's a place to go to report suspected abuse. But number two, put the bad folks on notice that this is out there.
I agree 100%. Too often they've had a sort of an easy run of this, and there's so many scams out there, and there's so many that, you know, shoot, I get them on my government email about, you know, the wealthy prince in somewhere in Africa, and I get them myself, so
yeah.
I can only imagine what my mom and my grandma are getting at home as well, and I've certainly had this conversation with them, as we've had this conversation with so many elder groups out there. The nice thing is, with things like that we did today, it's getting an awful lot of publicity now. You know, that case that I spoke about earlier, the $1.5 million, that got a lot of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the tip of the iceberg. For that one case, we've had hundreds of cases where senior citizens are, you know, violated in so many different ways that don't make the press because it's not $1 million or someone wasn't murdered. So this is an ongoing problem that's really growing, but it doesn't necessarily make the papers all the time.
Well, Prosecutor Eric Smith, what are your hopes for the No Excuse for Elder Abuse campaign in Macomb County and really throughout Michigan?
You know, we like to say we're tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime around here. You know, once a crime is committed, you're never going to find anyone tougher on that defendant than us. But if we can get in front of some of these crimes, stop them before they happen, then we can sort of, you know, we can put our resources towards other things, and that's what we'd like to do overall. But if we can get into seniors, you know, get into their mindset that, you know, being trusting to people on the phone or being trusting on emails or, you know, trusting to home care workers, if we can stop a lot of this behavior before crimes ever start, then we're, you know, then no senior citizen is losing all their money or losing their trust or losing, you know, their liberties by being subject to these things. So our goal here is to get in front of the crime and stop it before it happens.
Macomb County Prosecutor Eric Smith on the No Excuse for Elder Abuse campaign. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And there will be public service announcements hitting the airwaves promoting the confidential hotline for reporting abuse. The number again, 855-444-3911, and we will have that hotline number posted on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A proposed wolf hunt in Michigan could be put on hold, even though the legislature approved a wolf hunting bill during the lame duck session last December. That's because today the group Keep Michigan Wolves Protected delivered more than 250,000 petition signatures to the Secretary of State's office. Their petition calls for a statewide vote on whether or not to allow wolf hunting. That vote would be in November of 2014. Now, it wasn't that long ago the gray wolf was on the endangered list in Michigan, but state wildlife experts think there are now about 700 gray wolves in our state, and farming and hunting groups say that's now large enough that a state-regulated hunt should be done to manage the wolf population. Opponents of a hunt have rallied, and they insist the population is still too small and a hunt is cruel. Joining us now from Lansing is Jill Fritz, who's the director of Keep Michigan Wolves Protected. Welcome to Stateside, Jill.
Thank you.
So let me start by getting your perspective on that law that was passed in lame duck last December to allow a state-regulated wolf hunt. That was in response to groups who say it's time to control the wolf population. So your thoughts?
Well, the law was completely unnecessary. Wolves were just removed from the endangered species list last year. There are only 687 of them in the UP right now. There's already a law that allows problem wolves to be managed, and so there's no reason to start a wolf hunting and trapping season on this still recovering species.
All right, here's the question, because there are experts who are being paid by the Michigan Department of Natural Resources who are studying this issue. Why not wait and let the wildlife experts determine whether or not a hunt's a good idea?
Well, if you could find some experts who were actually there in the legislature when the bill was being passed, I would have been very surprised, because there were none. The bill was shoved through the lame duck session of the legislature with no supporting scientific evidence that a wolf hunt was needed. There was nothing but hearsay and misinformation provided to support an open season on wolves. And so the experts were not there. And so the law was passed. And again, it's an unnecessary law to have in the first place, because the current law says that if a wolf is attacking livestock or a dog, you may remove or shoot the wolf. So an open season, a random hunting season on wolves, would accomplish nothing and would be simply for trophies.
Just want to ask again about the, because we actually talked to one of the wildlife experts from the DNR on Stateside who is studying this and making recommendations as to whether or not a hunt should be allowed. Do you not trust the DNR?
No, I'm not making the DNR out to be the villains in this case. It is extremist hunting groups who are calling for a wolf hunt in our state, and they were the ones pushing the legislation through. Again, with no scientific evidence or documentation that a wolf hunt was needed.
Jill, as the director of Keep Michigan Wolves Protected, I know there was a huge effort to get those more than 250,000 signatures on the petitions in a very short period of time. I know now the Board of State Canvassers has 60 days to determine if there are enough valid signatures, and if that's the case, then the public would get to vote on the measure in 2014. I'm wondering, what is it that, for you personally, that drives you to care so much about the wolves?
Well, it's just seeing this species that has been had been persecuted for so long and nearly driven to extinction, now just still starting to recover and to populate back into the Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Seeing the possibility that they may be going under the gun so soon after being delisted, and also facing other inhumane types of practices like trapping. It's just very distressing and something that I and clearly many Michiganders also feel is very important.
So you'll be watching after the State Board of Canvassers or Board of State Canvassers makes its decision, and then it looks like you'll be gearing up for a ballot fight, or you certainly hope you will be.
Absolutely, and we're confident that they'll find more than the needed 161,000 plus valid signatures to qualify us for the ballot.
Jill Fritz is the director of Keep Michigan Wolves Protected. She spoke to us today from Lansing. Jill, thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
And in other, well, animal-related news, it looks like we Michiganders can now cuddle with, wait for it, real live bears. Governor Rick Snyder has signed a bill allowing the owners of an Upper Peninsula ranch to let visitors pet and have their picture taken with bear cubs. The law would let us hold bear cubs as long as they were under 36 weeks old or weighing less than 90 pounds. I don't know how cuddleable they be after they top 90 pounds. That law is limited to already existing facilities. There is absolutely no arguing the fact that modern medicine can truly produce miracles. Things can be done to extend our lives in ways that our grandparents or our great-grandparents could have barely imagined. But with these stunning advances in medical knowledge, pharmacology, technology, come new challenges. Just because you can pull out the stops and treat a patient, does it mean you should? At what point do you say medical care should shift from treatment to comfort? Dr. Nishant Shekharan is an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of Michigan. And this week, Michigan Radio is airing his reports on the growing field of palliative care. Dr. Nishant Shekharan joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think just about everybody listening is extremely familiar with the concept of hospice care. But in your reports, you're showing us there's a real distinction between hospice care and palliative care. Can you explain the difference and the similarities?
Sure. So let's start with the similarities. Both are focused on relieving patient suffering. And typically, palliative care is directed towards patients with a serious illness, no matter the stage of the diagnosis. Hospice care can be thought of as palliative care in the last 6 months of life. So palliative care is thought to complement traditional medical care. That is, you can have both curative therapy and palliative care at the same time.
So you're not throwing in the towel as a physician as such, but it's not as aggressive? Would that be the difference?
Well, I think there's different ways to frame it. When I talk to my patients, I typically frame it as, we are going to be very aggressive about focusing on your quality of life. That does not mean that you cannot also be aggressive with pursuing the medical therapy that people find that is consistent with their wishes and their goals of care. And palliative care is really about clarifying what patients' goals of care are while focusing on both the physical and psychosocial aspects of illness.
So you're thinking comfort, even as you may be searching for treatment.
That is correct.
Physical and spiritual, it sounds like.
You really want to give the patient the highest quality of life possible. And quality of life is defined by the patient, their families, and may be different for different people.
So when you drew up your reports that have been airing this week, give us an example of how that works for a patient. What does that feel like if you're a patient and the family, and you seek out palliative care?
So, for example, we talked with Rose Mark during our first report. And Rose Mark, before she went to the hospital, was a very functional, independent woman.
Elderly?
She was an elderly woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived in Ann Arbor, but she lived in her own place. She had some assistance, but largely she had her own group of friends. She kind of went about her day and had family close by. Rose Mark abruptly developed a heart condition, and it put her in the hospital. And that is a huge change for older patients when they go to the hospital. They have changes in their functional state. They can have changes in the way they think, process information. And it really takes an emotional and sometimes a very high financial toll on people.
I can imagine it changes the way they view themselves. And I imagine that really impacts just everything for their mindset.
And that's exactly what Rosemark told us. So when you're sitting there in your most vulnerable state, mm-hmm. She really thought about the bigger picture of her life. And one of the most poignant stories that Rosemark and her daughter shared with us was her reconciling a very tense relationship with her young son. And when palliative care came in to talk to her about her overall quality of life, this was one aspect that was very important to her and that she needed to resolve. And so not only did she have her physical symptoms attended to, but she also had these very important emotional components attended to as well. It was interesting when her younger daughter, Lisa Mark, characterized her as being able to fly after she was encouraged to have a conversation with her son.
When we're talking about the palliative care, what type of team is involved? Is it similar to a hospice team?
So a palliative care team is multidimensional. So it will include a primary clinician, be it a physician or a nurse practitioner. There will be nursing assistants at help, and therapists, physical therapists, potentially occupational therapists, chaplains, and importantly, social workers.
I'm speaking with Nishant Shekharan, an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of Michigan. This week, Michigan Radio is airing his reports on the growing field of palliative care. And I've got to imagine palliative care can have an impact on healthcare costs as well as the quality of life for a patient, true?
Well, that's what some of the data is pointing to. And I think people in the palliative care community and the payer community are recognizing the potential for this. I had the chance to talk with Dr. David Scheer, who's with Blue Cross Blue Shield in Michigan, and this is what he had to say.
Palliative care then can achieve a substantial savings by avoiding expensive, unnecessary, non-value-added care, which importantly frees up more resources to better organize care, coordinate care, and better meet patients' needs. So from every perspective, palliative care can lead to a more effective healthcare system.
So, Dr. Shekharan, when you're hearing doctors like Dr. Scheer at Blue Cross Blue Shield, and he's talking about the impact in healthcare costs, this has to be extremely important when you're looking at this huge, huge bubble of baby boomers getting older by the minute. And we're looking at, for families, it means how do we take care of mom and dad, and also how do we keep healthcare costs from breaking us?
Yeah, and I would probably emphasize here that we shouldn't look at costs in isolation. The discussion that we really want to be having is about value, and that is how can we get the best healthcare outcomes at the most affordable price. And when we talk about outcomes, what we're really talking about is improving the benefits of medical care and minimizing the harms of medical care. We talked with Dr. Dan Maison, who's the palliative care lead at Spectrum Hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he really emphasized the increasing complexity of medical care and how important it is to acknowledge that and have these conversations early. This is what he said.
And as we ask patients and families to partner with us to make these incredibly challenging decisions as the medical complexity continues to increase, I believe that the medical team and patients and families are going to need even more support in helping people work through what those decisions are. And palliative care is one service that can help people navigate that very well.
And is that something that is widely available? If I'm putting my mom into a hospital somewhere up north, will I be able to find palliative care, or is it spotty?
Well, it all depends where you live and who you ask. Mm. There's the Center for Palliative Care Research, and they give a report card to every state. And Michigan got a B. What that means is that we have palliative care in most hospitals throughout the state, particularly the large hospitals. But in the smaller hospitals, especially those with near less than 300 beds, mm-hmm. it's maybe a little tricky to find. And there are a few reasons for that. Another important point to acknowledge is that We're doing better in the hospital setting, but it's still a challenge when folks are out of the hospital or even before they enter the hospital.
And that's what I wondered. So if patients, like you referred to Rose, if Rose goes home, is that support still there? I know with hospice care, they do follow you home. They'll follow you into the nursing home because you're looking at those last 6 months of life. But it's a different story then for this concept of palliative care, correct?
This is true. It is challenging to get funding for palliative care, and the reason are a couple-fold. Number one, palliative care is not a revenue generator in the same way we think of other specialty services. The business promise, if you will, is really that you can save costs on the tail end by providing better and better care up front. The other side is that the hospitals need resources to provide for these teams. And there are a limited number of palliative care providers available to provide these services. In the outpatient setting, we're gradually seeing hospice companies providing some of these resources for palliative care patients. But there are a few of them. One of the people we talked with was Arbor Palliative Care, which is part of Arbor Hospice in Ann Arbor. I talked with Hillary McConaughey, who's one of the nurse practitioners there. And she mentioned that outpatient care was excellent. It was really helpful. There are some challenges also, and these pertain to communication. This is what she said.
I think as a provider, one of our biggest challenges is communication. Typically, the patients refer to us. They'll have a primary care physician, but they probably see at least one, if not multiple, specialists. And if they're still receiving active treatment, then really there's multiple outpatient physicians that need to be kept abreast of what we're doing in the home. And that is challenging, to get a hold of people and just to keep everyone on the same page. Communication is key.
I'm speaking with Dr. Nishant Shekharan, who is with the University of Michigan. He's an assistant clinical professor of medicine and also serving as a reporter this week on Michigan Radio, airing his reports on the growing field of palliative care. You teach, you care for patients at the University of Michigan Hospital and the Ann Arbor VA Health System, so you are a busy, busy person. I'm wondering, why did you feel it was important for you to carve out the time to produce and report these stories for Michigan Radio listeners? What do you want people to get out of them?
Well, medical illness is extremely complex. It's difficult for patients, it's difficult for families, and it's having increasing social impact. And it's important for medical care to be consistent with patients' values. And oftentimes, it's sometimes difficult to really be clear about what patients' values are because there may be limited time or even limited training in how to elicit those preferences. Palliative care seems to be one service that puts together both the clinical aspects that we traditionally consider as well as the important psychosocial aspects of medicine. When you combine those things together, we are seeing increasingly that it does have the potential to address some important health system problems.
So what's the takeaway? If I'm sitting in Grand Rapids today and I'm listening to this conversation, what is it you want the public to be aware of with palliative care? What can we do? How do we seek it out? What should we know about it?
Well, I think for patients and families, they should be aware that there are specialized services that can help them disentangle the complexities of medical care and make sure that the health system is better matching their expectations. For providers, similarly, they should also be aware that there is a service that can help them better understand their patients and ensure the treatments that they are recommending are consistent with what patients actually want.
Well, the reports can be found on our website. You can go to michiganradio.org, and you'll find Dr. Nishant Shekharan's reports on palliative care, michiganradio.org. Thank you so much for talking with us and for sharing your insights as a reporter and as a physician.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 2008, General Motors shuttered a stamping plant in Wyoming, just outside of Grand Rapids. But to Austin Bunn, a new professor of writing at Grand Valley State University, the close of that plant wasn't the end of the story. It was really the beginning. For the next 4 years, Bunn interviewed the workers at the plant about the experience of job loss, displacement, and what their lives were like after the close. From these transcripts, he created a documentary play, Rust, originally produced at the Actors Theater of Grand Rapids. What you're about to hear is an adaptation of the play for radio using local actors.
This is a story about what happens to the people who make things when we stop making things. 4 years ago, I moved to Michigan for a teaching job, and the close of this auto plant was all over the news.
General Motors announcing that it is closing its plant on 36th Street here in Wyoming, a move that will cost 1,200 people their jobs.
Heard the news and cannot believe it.
Shock and sadness on the floor of the factory.
And I just can't tell you how bad I feel for what's going on today in this community, in this plant.
The feeling of a funeral, of a wake down here, Rachel.
Yeah, very sad.
If you've ever lived in the Rust Belt, these kinds of announcements are not new. Plant closings got so bad in the early 80s that they had a bumper sticker: last one out of Michigan, turn off the lights. But I had just moved to Grand Rapids, about 15 minutes away from Wyoming, and the idea that 1,200 people would lose their jobs, including the mayor of Wyoming who worked at the plant, was shocking to me. What would happen to them? What would they do now? My father lost his job in his 50s, and he never had full-time work again. It changed him. He lost the plot. I thought maybe if I met the people who worked at the plant and understood what they were going through, I could find out how people get from one way of life to another. Now, I'm not a radio producer, I'm a playwright. I did almost 100 interviews with the people who worked at that plant, but I've learned you can't get 100 voices on the radio. So I distilled down what I heard and then worked with actors to portray the cast of characters that I met over 3.5 years of interviewing. So let's start with a tour. The plant on 36th Street in Wyoming looks like an enormous box. It stretches for what must be a half a mile. It sits next to a railway line and a highway. There's a bank across the street and a school nearby. A gate surrounds the place, covered in barbed wire. When I pull into the visitor's lot, I realize my tiny Honda is the only non-GM, non-gigantic truck in the place.
Yeah, smell that? Say, you can't smell the oil anymore. That's how you know it's really over.
This is Dave, the head of the union and my tour guide. When I went to meet him at the plant, he was one of just a few people left.
Where is everybody?
Laid off, transferred, retired, what have you. Skeleton crew now.
So what am I looking at? Tell me about this layout. Can we walk? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Let me show you this place here. Okay. You've got, first, way over there, up top, that's the offices.
Okay.
And in the back, you got production.
Okay.
Do you know what a die is?
No.
As we walk around the place, I keep seeing these little habitats, evidence of the people that work there. A post-it note on an abandoned toolbox that says, Dan is gone. A barrel full of work boots.
Well, it's just hard to understand what happened here with it so empty.
You should have been here 6 months ago.
The place is a ghost town.
Hello?
I want to meet some of the ghosts.
Is anybody here?
It was just supposed to be a summer thing.
So I'm 22, with a wife, kid, no job.
My husband said, you can't do this.
Nobody was born wanting to be an auto worker.
I looked at what I'd be making in the plant, and then what I'd be making in any other job, and...
The choice was obvious.
40 hours instead of 70.
And make the same money.
It's a big place.
You used to not even be able to see through there because the air was so bad.
People had been killed there.
Crushed.
The dyes, the steel.
Stuff weighs a frickin' ton.
We've had 8 people die in there since it opened. Good day at GM was when you got home with 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Will you miss this place?
The building? Nah, but the people. And right here is where we got the news, up there on the podium.
It was 2 o'clock, and they told us to stop what we were doing.
This is Heather, one of the skilled laborers at the plant.
We knew it was nothing good. They weren't going to shut every section down to meet for something good.
Effective immediately, the Grand Rapids metal plant will be phased out of operation. We will cover all of your concerns in the volume of this speech. We will not be taking questions.
We were just numb.
Heather had two sons, and her husband was unemployed because of health problems.
After the announcement, nobody was doing anything. I'd be at my station, and a guy would come over. I don't remember who was the first. It got to be so many. Usually he wouldn't say anything, just stand there. I mean, a guy's not going to go up to another guy and tell him how he's feeling, right? And then he'd start. What if I lose the house? How am I going to tell my family? What if I get transferred to Indiana or farther?
Faced with the end of her job at the plant, Heather was hoping for a transfer to Lansing, about an hour away. She became one of the GM gypsies, one of hundreds.
You want some tequila? Come on.
This is Rick, an electrician at the plant.
I wasn't surprised the place closed. I'm surprised it took this long. I mean, come on, there's a guy that worked there. They keep promoting him, even though we suck. Like, he's a supervisor, and everyone hated him so much, they had to move him. So they made him the supervisor of the supervisors, I guess. No one liked him even then, so you know, they promoted him again. This plant closing? That's not a tragedy. I mean, my wife and I, we lost two kids. I mean, that's a tragedy. A plant was a click. That little boy running around here, I'm transferring because it's all about that little boy. I'm just a migrant worker.
Out of 1,200 employees at the plant, 700 transfer elsewhere. A few hundred retire, and the rest take a buyout, which means losing their pension. Hundreds of people start moving out of town, out of state, anything to hang on to their jobs. I'm coming to understand that mobility has been a General Motors way of life. They close one plant, they open another. Creative destruction, economists call it. Alfred P. Sloan, the former president of General Motors, gave it a different name.
I call it another epic American migration.
From Sloan's 1926 autobiography, Adventures of a White-Collar Man.
There is no one so hopeless as a worker exiled from his family, surrounded by factory after factory. We must take the work out of the industrial centers and into America.
This strategy to decentralize and scatter plants across the country wasn't just a boon for small towns like Wyoming. It was an attempt to escape the force of unions forming in Detroit, where GM had its headquarters. In 1936, workers at a GM plant in Flint formed the United Auto Workers and struck for better pay. The plant in Wyoming, Michigan, almost 2.5 hours from Flint, opened a year later. After the plant went dark, the UAW closed its shop and employees had a final picnic. Workers threw their boots and hard hats high up into the branches of a tree that arced over the picnic tables. The plant got emptied out by demolition guys, and anything worth anything was sold at an auction. As one of the consultants told me, you can now make more money taking apart a plant than you could working there while it was open. Drive an hour north of Grand Rapids to meet a longtime GM tradesman named Jack. He worked at the Wyoming plant for 24 years.
Let me say this. GM was a great company.
He lives in a small trailer way out in the woods. I interview him on his deck. He's wearing a brace, and he tells me that he's got prostate cancer.
I know there's people that come home and hate everything they do, but I've always loved being a dye maker.
What shift were you on?
Third for most of it.
Wait, is third the...
It's the night shift, yeah, start at 11, finish at 7. I'd work, drive the kids to school in the morning, then I'd climb into bed, and then finally get up to start dinner.
Man, that's rough.
It is rough.
We talked about Jack's surgery, and then the conversation began to change.
It's moved into my spine. I just had an operation. That's why I'm in this brace. I go back to work Monday.
Monday? You don't get any time to recuperate.
Can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
What's an individual driving a foreign car for?
You mean me? What am I doing?
I see your Honda parked out on my lawn. I think we're both trying to understand each other.
Well, I bought it when I was in graduate school. I had always heard that American cars were unreliable.
Now, who'd you hear that from?
I heard it from everyone I knew growing up.
Where?
In New Jersey.
The coasts always give us our biggest negativity.
Why would that be?
Who knows? I heard some GM employee bragging about what they made or how little they did. They see someone like Wagoner running GM, making, what, $17
million? $17 million? That doesn't bother you at all?
No, it doesn't. Wagoner worked hard. I worked hard. We're a capitalist country. I don't get mad at GM. I don't file workman's comp.
Do you think the cancer may have been a result of working in that place?
They've tied prostate cancer to metalworking fluids, and there's no prostate cancer in my family.
So you're not bitter?
GM gave me the opportunity and a couple of risks. Losing a job is a risk. Getting sick is a risk.
A big risk, sir.
Yeah, from where you sit and your reliable car.
I began to think after I interviewed Jack that this project was about loyalty, which, frankly, I don't understand. I don't think anybody my age would understand. In my work history, I've been a window dresser, a game designer for reality television, a journalist, and now a teacher. Every single one of those jobs I had in a different state. The world that Jack lived in, of working for the same company for decades, a company loyal to its workers, doesn't seem to exist anymore. What do we have instead? Freelance, free agency, freedom. But is the world a better place for it? Where does that loyalty go when it goes? If I was learning anything from the workers at the plant, it was that there was a freedom to loyalty, too. The freedom from a certain kind of anxiety. The typical American worker now spends just 4 years at his or her current job, which means that our time gets spent increasingly on negotiating that change. On asking the questions, where will I live, what will I do, am I useful, that the lifers at General Motors never had to ask. Until, of course, now. Meanwhile, General Motors just posted some of the biggest profits in 10 years. I kept thinking at some point with all these interviews, I'd meet the enemy, the guy responsible for closing the plant, for people losing their jobs, the proverbial axe man. And then finally, I did.
I drove the final nail. This is when I was at GM headquarters, or as I like to call it, my time in hell.
This is Don, the comptroller of the Wyoming plant. I interviewed him in his kitchen.
Closing a plant starts with a white paper for the executives.
I'm sorry, a white paper?
Yeah, a white paper. You did the basic public research, you know, you found out what businesses were hiring, or maybe GM could absorb some of the people without them being displaced. You know, I'd call a plant, ask some loaded questions, but you had to do it so the people never really could figure out what was going on. You know, you don't want to tip your hand, so to speak, especially letting the workforce know. That's deadly.
After working in Detroit for a number of years, Don transferred to Wyoming and took over the plant.
I never thought a close would happen to me, but it didn't matter. They just kept ticking them off. Well, I put in 40 years, and my last day, I just snuck away. I did not want a party. When I got home, my wife had a glass of scotch and a bowl of popcorn for me. That was it. But then Thanksgiving comes, and all my kids and grandkids were there. I don't know what got into me. I brought out this box, and it had all these plaques of recognition, a quality award that I won from the Chamber of Commerce. Kids had never seen any of it. I told them, this is my retirement party. You guys are the ones I work for. You guys are the ones who got me through.
Do you know why the car industry started in Michigan? The trees. Hickory used to cover the whole southern part of the state, and hickory wood is hard and dense, good for making carriages so they wouldn't break. The carriage companies take off in Michigan, and the carriage companies grow up into the car companies. I moved this year away from Michigan. I followed a job, another epic migration in a life of them. I'm a gypsy now. Before I left, I drove by the plant. There's nothing left. They've completed the demolition. I'd been interviewing folks from the plant for almost 4 years, and I felt like an anchor that had been holding me to the area was now gone. They're looking for a buyer for the location, what they now call Site 36. The sales pitch is slick and sounds like this.
Site 36 is a unique development opportunity located just outside Grand Rapids in the city of Wyoming. This 92-acre site was the former home to a General Motors stamping plant for 73 years.
The only thing that remains is one of the trees out front, one of the trees with the boots and the hard hats flown up into it. I parked out front, and I wondered what the new owners will think when they move in. Will they wonder what happened here or think about the people and the families that grew up in the shade of that tree? Does our hard work get somehow written into the places that we live? What happens if it doesn't? My heart felt heavy as I drove home. The next day, I packed up my things, and like so many of the folks that I'd interviewed, I got on the road.
Rust was co-produced by Austin Bunn and Zach Rosen. Interviews were conducted by Austin Bunn and Working Group Theater. And now we move from a story of job loss to today's release of Michigan's unemployment numbers. Our state's jobless rate decreased slightly last month to 8.8%. That's down from 8.9% in both January and December. Nationwide, the unemployment rate was more than a percentage point lower than Michigan's last month at 7.7%. So, got something to tell us? A story you think we should know about? Someone we should feature? Let us know. We're on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. On Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Or find us at the website, michiganradio.org, and just click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you.